Somebody's cutting the head off a human being. For what purpose?
There's a fusion of sex and aggression.
This was exceptionally brutal.
A serial killer is stalking young women on the Sunset Strip.
He said, remember those two girls? Well, I killed them, and now I'm coming for you.
She addressed him as her lord and master.
I would not be amazed if we'd found out that she had pulled the trigger.
A perverted game of sex and murder, played by two unlikely suspects.
I've examined all the evidence, and it kills me that I'm never going to know the truth here.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Writer Mark McNamara investigates murder on the Sunset Strip.
People in series or serial murders has police departments across this country worried.
A Justice Department investigator calls it terrifying, an epidemic.
That spring and summer of 1980, there were several serial killers all working in Los Angeles.
There have been 13 young women killed.
Motiveless, random killings.
Randy Kraft was working in the South. The Hillside Strangler was working further north in Los Angeles.
Police say they don't know whether they're looking for one killer or many killers.
At the time, we were considered the homicide capital of the world, or the United States at least. I believe we had close to 1,200 homicides within the city of Los Angeles. We were running hard at that time, fast and furious.
In June 1980, 15-year-old Cindy Chandler and 16-year-old Gina Marano have run away from their home in suburban Orange County. They head to Los Angeles, drawn to the glamour and excitement of the big city, unaware just how extraordinarily dangerous it has become.
Cindy and Gina were from a nice middle-class family from down in the beach area. Both attractive young girls, raised with respect and understanding of what's good and what's not. They were hitchhikers, which is a dangerous thing to do anywhere for young ladies. But kids are gonna be kids, and these were kids.
Shortly after they arrive, the girls hear about a party in the Hollywood Hills. They're younger than most and stand out in the crowd. Mindy Cohen, another guest at the party, introduces herself.
She was a young gal of privilege. Her family was wealthy. She befriended them, and she had given both Cindy and Gina her number and said if they needed something, to please give her a call, that she would do what she could to help them out while they were in town.
On June 8th, Gina speaks with her father, Angelo Marano. Gina says they've been staying with a movie producer in the Hollywood Hills. The young women can't believe their good luck.
These two young girls, they were in the prime of their life.
4 days later.
LAPD were called to the scene in Burbank today after the bodies of two teenage girls were found shot dead.
We had female victims, relatively young age. They were on a sloped area off of the on-ramp for the Ventura Freeway.
The young girls are found naked with no identification. It's only when Gina Marano's father sees the news reports and calls the LAPD that authorities are able to confirm the victims are Cindy Chandler and Gina Marano. The girls were last seen alive on the Sunset Strip.
There was evidence of sexual trauma. We noticed like a slice or a tear in the clothing. In all likelihood, they were moved after death.
With regard to Cynthia Chandler, there was spermatozoa in her mouth, also in her vaginal area. She was shot once in the head and once in the heart, and Gina Marano was shot twice in the head.
bullets were taken from the bodies at the coroner's during the autopsies. It was determined by our ballistics and firearms specialists that they were from a 25 automatic called a Raven. Finding multiple victims out there, it was frightening to think that we might have another string of murders.
The police department has issued warnings to young women not to hitchhike or walk alone, especially at night.
There's all kinds of speculation here that you could look at whether or not it's a copycat murder.
If you'd have asked me that day what I thought we had here, I might have said this could very well be linked to the Hillside Strangler murders. At that time, we didn't know.
Two days later, police receive a startling phone call.
They had a call from a woman who offers a fair amount of information about the killings.
He said that he hit two teenage girls. You can verify this or not, because the papers do not say this. He tells me that he fired four shots.
This individual, she was giving bits and pieces that we didn't have the information on.
But I'm the only damn person in the world that knows. I know the killer. I may be the next one on his list.
The woman refuses to name the man she says killed Gina and Cindy, and she won't identify herself. When police try to trace the call, they're unable to track her down. While the investigation of the Sunset Strip murders continues, the death toll steadily climbs.
There was a murder, a naked victim, back in the darkened parking lot of a closed business, laying spread eagle.
My partner called me up that they had a nude body, a huge amount of blood streaming down to the sidewalk.
The body of another young woman is discovered behind a restaurant on Ventura Boulevard.
And she was decapitated and her head was missing, as was her clothing.
There's no evidence there. There was nothing there but the body.
My first thought was, oh my God, what have we got here? Somebody's cutting the head off a human being, a young girl. For what purpose?
It was obvious she had been sexually assaulted.
Here in Studio City, the headless girl found murdered on Monday was Exie Wilson from Little Rock.
Exie was 24. She was from the South, and she had followed her dreams and moved to Southern California to try to find a better life.
We had a friend from Little Rock. He was able to find out the address of where Exie's mom lived. We hit the trailer park. You know, it's just a sad, sad situation.
You know, we'd seen a lot of murders in our careers, but this was exceptionally brutal.
It took more than 20 serrated cuts to separate her head from her body.
5 days later, another gruesome discovery near the Sunset Strip.
This man, he drove down the driveway coming in to pull in to park behind his apartment. And here's this large wooden box that was partially open, laying on its side. There was an object inside.
Also in the box was a shirt which said Daddy's Girl on it.
And as he pulled those pieces of clothing back, Exie's face was exposed. Her decapitated head was under that clothing.
Her head was found in the 12400 block of Ventura in an alley in this box.
She had died of gunshot wounds to her head, similar to the other victims.
The bullet recovered was later examined and determined to be a 25 caliber automatic from a Raven automatic.
The same weapon used to kill Cindy Chandler and Gina Marano. Investigators are convinced the murders are connected, the work of a new killer who stalks young women on the Sunset Strip.
Police are still looking for more information. If you have anything on the killing of Exie Wilson or on the two teenagers from Huntington Beach who were also murdered, please call the Los Angeles Police Department Homicide Division.
Police receive thousands of tips, but on August 11th, one call in particular grabs the detective's attention. It's the same woman who claimed to know the Sunset Strip killer. This time, she identifies herself. She's Carol Bundy, a 40-year-old nurse living in the San Fernando Valley.
Carol is a small, round woman with bottle-thick glasses. The most striking thing about her is her little girl's voice, a teenager's voice.
Vanity Fair writer Mark McNamara spent more than 20 hours interviewing Carol Bundy.
I think of all the stories that she told me, it was always difficult to tell when she's giving you the truth and when she's not. But the stories that she told about her childhood was, by all accounts, horrific.
She had a background of abuse from both her mother and her father. Both her parents are alcoholic.
Carol Bundy had a mother who died when she was very young. She was sexually abused by her own father.
She was sexually active with her father till she met her first husband and married him. The actual marriage lasted just a few days. There were sexual problems related to the husband wanting to invite his friends and having good time with his wife, some for free and some for money.
9 years after Carol divorces her husband, she meets Grant Bundy. They get married in 1969. It is another emotionally and physically abusive relationship.
Second marriage lasted quite a few years, but they ended up separating and they got divorced.
At the time that I left my husband, I had no idea where I was going. I just had to get away.
Carol Bundy moves into a low-cost apartment directly upstairs from the building manager, Jack Murray.
Jack Murray is an Australian who finds his way to the United States and marries a woman, and together they run a little apartment complex.
Jack had been a well-received Australian country western singer at Little Nashville, which was a bar in the North Hollywood Van Nuys area.
He was a ladies' man. They quickly become lovers. It was well known to everybody who lived in the complex what that relationship was. She was very open about it, much to the chagrin of Jack's wife.
I'm very docile and submissive, and I think that he liked that.
Her fantasy was just having someone pay attention to her. And the only way in Bundy's entire life that men paid attention to her is they had sex with her.
The worst thing that he did was he emotionally injured me. I was willing to overlook the abuse. I loved the man.
Jack, he was certainly rough and impervious to her desires. She addressed him at one point as her lord and master.
Jack was aware that he could hurt people, and he didn't give a damn.
Well, in fact, Jack did what he wanted to do, right?
Yes, he did. He always did.
As Carol Bundy describes her relationship with Jack Murray, Mark McNamara begins to wonder, could Jack Murray have been the Sunset Strip killer? Vicious murders terrorizes Los Angeles and weighs heavily even on the reporters covering the story.
The tricky thing when you do these kinds of stories, if you spend time in the dark side, it leaves an effect.
More than 20 years ago, Vanity Fair writer Mark McNamara spent 2 years investigating the case of the Sunset Strip killer. It's a story that continues to haunt him.
When I first sat down with Carol Bundy, not just once, but maybe several times, she made the point that this is a mystery that you'll never solve.
Police reported the killing of the girls may be connected.
Police emergency 359, can I help you?
So the investigation continues, with detectives apparently still working on the premise the girls were killed by one man and one weapon.
When McNamara starts to examine the case files, he reviews Carol Bundy's telephone call to the police, claiming she had information on the Sunset Strip killer. McNamara wonders, could Jack Murray, the abusive man Bundy is having an affair with, be connected to the murders?
She claimed he was always borrowing money. And at one point, he told her that his wife was ill with cancer.
Jack tells Carol that he needs money for his wife's chemotherapy. Convinced that he will leave her once the cancer is in remission, Carol loans Jack over $10,000 for the treatments.
Then it turned out he didn't use the money for that at all, and she didn't have cancer, and then the money went to a van payment.
He told people that he liked me. The reality of it is that he used me.
Heartbroken, Carol moves out of the apartment complex and away from Jack Murray. Carol is alone once again, but she won't be for long.
The San Fernando Valley was an underworld of blue-collar neighborhoods. And at night, a lot of these people would congregate at these little nightclubs. And these were unbelievably dark little places.
Carol Bundy goes to the local club, Little Nashville, looking for a good time. Almost as soon as she walks in, she notices a man staring at her from across the bar.
If there ever was an individual that saw themselves as a ladies' man, he was that individual.
He's a very affable guy, very intelligent, and looked you in the eye.
He is a bright and charming 32-year-old named Douglas Clark.
He grew up in a Navy family. They traveled all over the world. He was someone that got along well with his parents, certainly respected his parents, particularly his father.
Doug Clark joins the Air Force. After he is honorably discharged, he moves to Los Angeles and lands a job as an engineer.
Doug worked for a large company that manufactured lotions. His job was to keep those boilers going.
He didn't have his own apartment. He would meet a girl at a bar, you know, become friends with her immediately, and then move in with her.
Doug Clark didn't have any male friends. None.
He sees Carol there at the bar. She had a house and a job, and what a great nest she would make for him.
They moved in together, but their sexual relationship quickly fell apart. Their sexual encounters were limited to two or three or four at the most.
In reality, he really didn't have any sexual interest in me. His interest in me was in my mind. These are where the fantasy started.
Everything that has always stimulated him in any way has to do with sex in one way or another.
Part of therapy involved capturing young women and subduing them, using them sexually.
They'd both had conversations regarding how they would easily be able to get young ladies into the car with them in the Hollywood area or in the Van Nuys area.
And one day, according to Carol, the fantasies become a reality.
And there was one story that she told in particular. Doug Clark was in the driver's seat, and they picked up a prostitute. And Carol said, I need you to be a birthday present for my boyfriend. And so the girl got in the car.
I was in the back seat while she was performing fellatio on him. Shot
it. Killers have rehearsed in their mind for years and years and years how it would feel to have that actual total life and death of the person in their hands.
And it wasn't until I was up to my nose in dead bodies that I realized that it was not a fantasy situation.
When she's talking to the police, the point that she wants to make over and over and over is that she only knows what Doug has told her.
In her second call to police, Carol claimed that it was Doug Clark who killed Gina Marano, Cindy Chandler, and Exie Wilson. She goes on to describe another victim the police never found.
The last hit, I have no real details of, except that he said that she's up by a water tower or two water towers. Just water towers.
3 weeks later, police find the body of a murder victim that matches Carol's description.
I flew out there. It's on the backside of Angeles National Forest, and it's desert-like.
It was obvious that cause of death was gunshot to the head.
Fortunate for us, her remains were pretty intact, and during the autopsy, we were able to recover another slug. It was from the same Raven automatic that had killed the girls.
He said that when he blew her away, that he really enjoyed doing that one.
And where is it going to stop?
Eventually, he's going to screw up.
No matter how many young ladies between now and that time will die. You can help us on his case.
I give you your basis. Now you know where to start.
Detectives are starting to suspect that Carol Bundy is more than just a witness to the Sunset Strip murders.
She's describing smells and sounds and sights, the account of someone who'd been there.
Could Carol be more involved than she's letting on?
But I'm just a flaky little housewife who happened to fall under the influence of a very dominant personality that just got out of my control.
We had one of the suspects involved. How deep, we didn't know. But we're getting close.
Carol Bundy calls the Los Angeles police, claiming that she knows the Sunset Strip killer. And she's about to tell them more, much more. 2 days earlier, the police were investigating another gruesome murder.
We had a decapitation. Male victim. It looked at that time like it was a sexual type killing. There were knife wounds to the scrotum, penis, and to the anus area.
I believe his body was in the van for about a week, and neighbors reported a terrible smell, and finally someone came and opened up the doors.
The only thing that was close to what we'd been investigating with the Sunset murders was a decapitation. We thought at that time it was not connected.
When Carol Bundy calls police to tell them the man she lives with, Douglas Clark, is the Sunset Strip killer, she surprises investigators with a story about her former lover, Jack Murray. It was his decapitated body police found in a van 2 days earlier.
One way or another, Jack was going to get it. Jack had very few real friends, and an awful lot of enemies. I don't know the real story on it, truthfully.
On the night Jack was murdered, he was at the Little Nashville. Carol walks in and says to Jack, "Would you come outside with me? I want to tell you something." She told him what Doug had been doing for these last couple of months.
I was convinced that Douglas was going to kill me that night. I ran to him and asked him to hide me for the night. He wouldn't. Things did not go as they should have.
She enticed him with oral sex and then had him on his hands and knees and pulled out the .25 Raven and shot him in the back of the head. Then sliced his body up with a knife. Carol went home and told Doug Clark, "I think I screwed up."
Carol says, "Look, I need you to come and help me right away." And then he goes down to the Datsun. And there in the passenger side is this head. He is absolutely aghast.
He told her, "Let's go get rid of it," and they drove off. It was put in a dumpster or a trash bin. We did searches in the area. That skull was never found.
While Carol Bundy is on the phone confessing to Jack Murray's murder, police surround her apartment.
You get a sense of relief on her part, like she was happy to talk about it.
Because she knows what Clark is capable of, and that's killing anybody, including her.
Carol Bundy is arrested and charged with first-degree murder. When police point out that the Sunset Strip killer decapitated one of his victims, just like she did, Carol claims she knows exactly how Doug Clark killed Exie Wilson.
And he picked up Exie, took her onto a parking lot, hit her head, set her head, dumped her over by Sizzler, and had her head in the back of the car. He was extremely nervous about driving around town with that damn head in the box. We stopped in the burger place and had a hamburger with Exie in the back seat, in her little box.
We know from the interviews with her that they took that head and washed the obvious blood off of the neck wound and the face and put it in their freezer.
Where I had my fun with it was with the makeup. I was thinking her of her mother's body doll.
Sure.
So we went and got all the damn cosmetics in her, making up her face. Then he wasn't happy because she was still half frozen.
She looked me straight in the eye and says, Leroy, have you ever tried to put lipstick on a frozen head? He says, it's a bitch. And I had no answer. And I says, are you kidding?
By the end of the interrogation, Carol Bundy has made two things very clear. First, she killed Jack Murray.
He didn't kill Jack. I did Jack. So hang him on his own stuff. Don't hang him on mine.
But Carol Bundy is adamant. It was Doug Clark alone who murdered at least six women during the summer of 1980. Police immediately take Clark into custody.
We had officers stationed outside the area that he worked, so we knew he wasn't going to try to make a run for it. We said, we're going to place you under arrest at this time and read him his Miranda rights.
My sense of Doug always begins with his amazed expression. A man who was caged and who basically had very little true character, had no moral compass whatsoever.
I put a lot of cuffs on a lot of people for a lot of bad things, but dealing with this guy, it was an education for me. He was self-assured that he was the smartest individual in that room, by far. He could talk his way through or around or out of anything.
Douglas Clark told the police in the middle of an interrogation that he agreed to. There's many things that I'm not going to be able to tell you, but I don't want you to know.
What investigators learn is darker and more disturbing than anyone imagined. Los Angeles police have Douglas Clark in custody. He is charged with a string of horrific murders.
He was the coolest under fire individual I had ever come in contact with as a criminal, ever.
His live-in girlfriend, Carol Bundy, just told investigators that Clark is the Sunset Strip killer. Clark insists he doesn't know anything about the murders.
He likes to portray himself as an innocent victim.
As police interrogate Clark, investigators search the apartment Clark shares with Carol Bundy.
There was a lot of pornography, very graphic magazines found. And one of my immediate finds was a photo album. And in this photo album was a critical piece of evidence.
In talking to Doug, like, he's so smart, that's his downfall. He doesn't know what we know. Arrogant as hell.
Clark maintains that cool composure until he's confronted with the evidence inside the photo album investigators found in his apartment.
We had better than 50 pictures of him involved in either Ashel or set up sexual acts with this young 11-year-old girl by the name of Shannon. And this young girl was dressed in clothing that could only be described as something you might see in a pornographic movie.
Shannon O was a girl that Carol Bundy and Douglas Clark frequently babysat. One thing Douglas Clark was embarrassed of was that he had that relationship. And he said, I don't want to talk about that. That was off limits, that topic.
He shut down when you brought that up. If there was a way to get to him, it was a little girl.
One of the things that Carol told me was that she was herself around that age when she was first molested by her father. And it was Carol who gradually introduced her to this sexual world that she and Doug were creating. Doug would later say, you know, I was presented with this and I didn't refuse it.
Shannon was just neglected. Douglas came along and gave her a lot of attention.
They started bringing Shannon O with them to Hollywood while Douglas Clark lured prostitutes into his car. He allowed Shannon O to watch prostitutes engage in oral copulation with him.
We filed a child molestation case with no bail to give us more time to investigate the murders. Now you've got him. Now you got to prove it.
After searching his apartment, detectives head to a storage unit rented by Clark.
We found the garage. The first thing you notice on the cement, you can see what we could call drag marks going across. Determine this is blood. It's just something you can't erase from your mind.
The police detected the blood of Gina Marano. When you have blood evidence and they compare both your blood type and enzyme characteristics, there's really no disputing that.
While the storage unit search continues, Detective Leroy Orozco heads back to police headquarters where Clark is being held with what turns out to be a crucial piece of evidence.
I recall being informed that they had discovered shoe prints on the floor in the concrete, and the shoe prints were quite clear. Doug Clark's seated there. He's handcuffed to a chair. He crossed his legs at one time, and he's got motorcycle boots on.
And there it is, the same pattern that I had seen in the garage.
We demanded that he take the boots off at that time. And I know, looking at his eyes, he's going, uh-oh.
Forensic analysis confirms the boots match the bloody footprints in the storage unit. Investigators can now link Clark to two of the victims, Cindy Chandler and Gina Marano. But they need more to make a murder charge stick. Police search the car where Carol Bundy claims Douglas Clark executed his victims.
Bullets were found in the Datsun, both in the door and in cushions in the car, in addition to blood that was connected to the victims.
And it wasn't too long after that it was determined by our ballistics and firearms specialists that they were from a 25 automatic.
All of the victims who died were killed by a 25 caliber Raven pistol. When the police said to Douglas Clark, we'd like to see those guns, instead of saying, I don't have them, he said, oh, I bet you would.
Clark refuses to answer any questions regarding the evidence police have recovered or the guns they suspect he used to kill his victims.
I don't think he's going to get rid of the guns. Those are a huge draw item for him to relive everything that he'd been involved in.
Investigators search Clark's apartment and storage unit without success. They head to where Clark worked, in the boiler room of the Andrew Juergens factory in Burbank.
So we went to management at this plant where he worked, and they offered to have their crews help us search the area. One of their employees slipped on a step, and a couple of bricks moved, and the mortar around him had been carved out, and in this little enclosure was a woman's cosmetic bag with two Raven automatics in there.
Clark continues to insist that he never killed anyone.
During the process, his wallet was removed from him, and we went through it.
They found Mindy Cohen's phone number.
Mindy Cohen, one of the last people to see 16-year-old Cindy Chandler and 15-year-old Gina Marano alive. Police immediately reach out to Mindy. She remembers a disturbing telephone call she received 6 weeks after she last saw Cindy and Gina.
She said, out of the blue, someone calls her up, claims to be from the Los Angeles Police Department, inquiring about two young teenagers who were murdered. He said, remember those two girls? Well, I killed them, and now I'm coming for you.
Mindy Cohen will never forget that phone call she received in the summer of 1980. An unidentified man was on the other end of the line.
He said, remember those two girls? Well, I killed them, and now I'm coming for you.
Some weeks later, the police went to play a voice recording for Mindy Cohen.
The police had Douglas Clark's voice because they had interviewed him. That was tape recorded, obviously. And they played a small snippet of that for Mindy Cohen, and she instantly recognized the voice.
Phone records confirm that a call was made from the apartment Doug Clark shares with Carol Bundy. Clark is charged with 6 counts of murder for Cindy Chandler, Gina Marano, and Exe Wilson. And 3 more victims, Marnette Comer, Karen Jones, and a woman known only as Jane Doe, number 18. Clark continues to maintain he never threatened Mindy Cohen and he never killed anyone.
Some of the gory details of the killings in this case will be disclosed on the record during the next week or so.
Before Carol Bundy was supposed to testify for the defense, the prosecutor in this case, Robert Jorgensen, very strategically gave her use immunity, which means that she can tell the truth.
Here's a woman who is screaming for attention on various levels. And so here she is on the stand in a trial where people are hanging on her every word.
She put the story together. She gave it life. Carol Bundy just put it in a story form that leaves your mouth open when you listen to it. It wasn't necessary for a conviction, but I think for a jury, it was just very impactful. The jury returned verdicts guilty as charged. 6 counts of first-degree premeditated murder.
Clark let it be known that since he was found guilty, he preferred death. Late this morning, he got his wish.
Defendant Douglas Daniel Clark shall have imposed upon him a sentence of death.
Doug Clark goes directly to San Quentin Prison to await execution. Carol Bundy's trial for the murder of Jack Murray is scheduled to begin 3 months later.
Carol Bundy, on the day of her trial, she decided to plead guilty in exchange for 52 years to life.
One of the great mysteries in this case is that after their convictions, they remained what appeared to be close friends. And there were lots of letters. Doug is on death row because of this woman, and yet he's perfectly willing to engage in this easy conversation with her.
In 1992, Clark appeals the decision with the California Supreme Court. His 6 murder convictions are upheld.
He lives by this case, and having just seen him recently, he is still just as intent upon clearing himself as he was all these years ago.
Mark McNamara still has questions about Carol Bundy's role in the Sunset Strip murders. Was Bundy more involved than she claims? Was she just a helpless witness? Or was Carol Bundy an executioner?
One of the diabolical things that she says is that in her experience with killing people, that it's really fun.
Really fun to do. Could Carol Bundy have pulled the trigger? She cut a head off, so I would be not amazed if she had actually pulled the trigger on one of the girls.
Serial sexual murder, for the most part, is a solitary, solo event. In this case, Bundy was really an assistant, but she also did it for her own purposes. She wanted to show Clark that she connected with him at his level.
I've examined all the evidence from so many different directions. Whether she pulled the trigger, I couldn't say, but I believe she was at every scene. There's no question of that.
Determined to know if Carol Bundy is telling the truth, Mark McNamara asks Bundy to prove her claims.
Would you be willing to have that on a live?
Certainly. But let me ask you a question. When these lie detectors test them, are you still going to believe that I'm openly lying, or will you accept that I'm telling the truth?
Carol Bundy dies in 2003 of heart failure. She never took the lie detector test.
When Carol died, it was another of those moments where I realized that I'm never going to know the truth.
This case is complicated because you can't believe anything that Clark or Bundy say. They are pathological liars.
It surprises me that he still likes to portray himself as an innocent victim. I believe there's other victims out there.
All these years later, those young women who were killed are erased. They made their way to Los Angeles, as so many young people have done over the years. And then this happens to them, and then, you know, this all becomes about the killers.
His vile self-assuredness doesn't allow him to say, you didn't catch me for these other 10 or 15 murders that I was involved in. I'm gonna tell you about them now. Come on, man. Take credit for your foul deeds. Let us at least give some families some relief. Identify these people. No. It won't happen.